Welcome to the Cullinane and Green Report and the final part of our 2005 review. Joe and Roger talk about the technology trends of 2005 that will drive business development in 2006 and beyond.
Welcome to the Cullinane and Green Report. I'm Joe Cullinane.
And I'm Roger Green.
If you've been tuning in, you know that we're doing our top review of 2005. And this is the fourth of our podcasts on this topic. The first one we did was Top Tech Trends for 2005. Then we did Top Products of 2005, followed by the Top Company of 2005. And I'm not going to disclose who that company was because I want you to go back and listen to that podcast. And then today we're going to talk about Top Trends. So, Roger, what's our first top trend for 2005?
Our first top trend, number one, and by the way, in no particular order, so number one doesn't mean that much, but the first one we're choosing to talk about is online advertising.
Online advertising. So what is online advertising?
Well, if you've used a web browser, you've seen it. Because if you go on websites and you see ads at the bottom or on the sides, this is a form of online advertising. If you've used Google and you put in a search term and you get your list of your 10,000 hits starting down the center of the page, you'll notice these little boxes on the right-hand side of the page with just a little bit of text that relate to what your search term was. Those are online ads that are actually triggered by what you asked in your search.
So why do you think people are turning to online advertising? Can you think of some reasons why this would be effective for our audience? Why would they want to do this?
Well, I think that from the advertiser's perspective, there is a lot of value to online ads as compared to the conventional mainstream advertising, newspapers, magazines, radios, and TV, for a couple of reasons. Number one, if they link it to a search term, and you're thinking of buying something, knowing that you are looking for something having to do with, let's say, flat screen televisions, they pop up things on the right-hand side. They actually get their message to an individual who's expressed an interest in the topic and possibly at one of the key magic moments when you're thinking of spending money, when you're thinking of buying something.
Right.
For an advertiser, that's the golden moment when they want to get to you.
Yeah, if you think about a television commercial, let's say you have a product that's directed towards men of a certain age group, 40 to 60, and you do a television advertisement. Now, hopefully you've selected the right channel or the right cable channel that goes after the demographic you're looking at. But you have to keep in mind that half the audience are women, half the audience are probably not in that target audience you're looking for. So therefore, it's not a very efficient way to reach an audience. And what you're saying is that with online advertising, there's a much higher likelihood that these are people that are really interested in the topic that you're advertising.
That's true. And it's also harder to dodge that ad. One of the trends, which is great for us folks who like to sit back and watch TV, but not so great for the people who are advertising on it, is that the modern digital video recorder, like the TiVo box or one that you get from your cable or satellite company, that allows you to record your shows and watch them later at your convenience. Just a week ago, I read that Cox Broadcasting, Cox Cable, estimates that about half of their viewers use digital video recorders, and of that amount, about 70% of the shows that they watch from the recorded version, not from the live version, which means that if you're paying for advertising on that show, the people, even if they're in the right demographic for you, are probably fast-forwarding through your commercial.
Yeah, I think that and a number of other things are really leading to this trend. I've seen statistics that say that the average person is bombarded with from 3,000 to 4,000 marketing messages a day. If you even take 3,000 a day, that's over a million marketing messages a year. So the noise level is really overwhelming. Another thing is people are starting to get really aggravated and annoyed by traditional advertising. I saw a statistic that said nearly 45% of the people say the amount of marketing and advertising to which they're exposed detracts from their experience of everyday life. Now, I didn't get into sales and marketing and business development to detract from people's experience of everyday life. I think you take into account what you mentioned about new technologies like TiVo and like caller ID. It's more and more difficult to reach these audiences with traditional marketing. And add to that legislation, no call lists and no soliciting laws. And so it really is becoming more and more difficult.
That's true. And in fact, Joe, you're touching on our second big item, which we might want to discuss in the same conversation. And that item is for trends is security and privacy. And unless you've been under a rock for the past year, you use a computer, you know about spyware and all of the various things that come up and can annoy you. Cookies that you don't want to get on your machine. Who even knew there were cookies a few years ago, and now you got to clean them off, you know, on your own. But these are the things that people feel that their lives are being invaded and in some cases being taken over by technology and even just by bombardment with phone calls.
Yeah, right. A lot of people, when they think about security and privacy, think about the obvious things like viruses that are created by these hackers who want to destroy your computer. But a lot of the things that gum up and your computer and really have an effect on your privacy are marketing-oriented online advertising-type tools like pop-ups, like spam, and emails, like adware, like spyware, where they actually are trying to figure out what you're looking at and keeping track of that. So the first trend, the online advertising, has a dark side that really affects our second trend, which is security and privacy.
That's very true. And what we've discovered and what the advertisers have discovered, and this I wouldn't call this a blazing insight, but it's an important one, is that if you make people angry, they're probably not going to buy your stuff. So when people were barraged in 2005 and particularly even in 2004 with pop-up ads, all of a sudden people were complaining, and companies like Microsoft and Firefox and their browser have built in these pop-up blockers. And in fact, even the dial-up services like AOL and Earthlink and others now claim to stop them right at the source. They don't even let it get past their servers to you.
Well, and so for our listeners, what are some of the issues that they should be concerned about in terms of security and privacy for 2006?
Well, we can certainly say that it started in 2005 as an amazing number of complicated security problems for almost everyone who owns a computer or uses one. And 2005 was probably the first year that it seemed as if Microsoft and the other companies who were producing products that were affected were almost unable to deal with it. They were almost overtaken by some of these massive worms and viruses that spread. So for sure, it's on everybody's radar now as a problem, and one that can actually reduce your computer to a pile of rubble. Now, the reason it's a trend is because we didn't solve the problem. Security issues looking out into 2006 and beyond are not going away. And at the same time that the hackers are becoming more sophisticated and motivated more by money than they are by just messing up people's machines, we are still faced with a very fragmented industry trying to provide security solutions. There is still no one solution that you can install on your machine which is going to protect you from the viruses, the worms, the Trojans, all the other things that are out there today.
Yeah, we also touched on some of the elements of privacy when we were talking about online advertising, and that's becoming a huge issue. In fact, I just read an article today about a Clinton, Iowa firm that was awarded an $11.2 billion award in an anti-spam suit. And this was from a Florida man who was sending millions of unsolicited emails and advertising mortgage and debt consolidation services. And so this ISP was able to win this huge award. And I think that's a great move, and I hope that trend continues.
Yeah, the enforcement is also a very tricky thing. Now, there was the beginning of cooperation in 2005 between the feds and the big companies like Microsoft and AOL. And in fact, by working together, they were able to nail a few of the spammers. But the problem continues. And when we speak of the privacy issues, one of the big problems that comes out of all of this security and privacy stuff is identity theft. which is certainly a phrase that really caught people's attention in 2005 and, again, is not going away. This is going to be a trend, and unfortunately, it's only partially solvable with technology. That is to say, when people – you've heard of phishing, of course, which is simply a word that is describing what is also called social engineering, which means you don't need technology to get people to give you their identity. What you can do is go ask them for it. If you fool them into going to a site where they have to input their details, you've got them, and they've done it for you. The problem with all of that is that this is the tip of the iceberg of the financial criminal who's now behind most of this stuff. It's shifted again away from being just hackers who are doing it for getting points among their community to organized crime. And in fact, one of the stats that I read a couple of weeks ago is that, again, for the first time, 2005, the amount of money that was stolen using the internet exceeds all other forms of theft in the world now.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, there's a trend I hope doesn't continue. Another trend I think our listeners should be aware of, if they're going to be advertising online, is click fraud. And you sent me an interesting article about click fraud, and click fraud basically is the act of a competitor clicking on your keywords and going to your site, and because there's a charge per word, they really use up your whole advertising budget, and it's really a terrible trend. And so you got anything to say about click fraud?
Well, it's certainly, as the very embryonic online advertising industry is getting going, this is probably the first major threat to it. And it's not coming from the other media as a competitive alternative, but instead it's coming from evildoers, if you will, who are
all over
there.
The place, those evildoers, aren't they?
That's a trend. There you go.
Yeah.
We're going to be hearing more about that in 2006,
right.
I promise. But the problem is that it could really derail some of the momentum, and there needs to be some solutions. And I think it's reflective, again, of the very early stages that we're in of online advertising, both in terms of the ability to generate good metrics about how it's being used, and all of the analytics around it. These are all symptomatic of it being very young. And I'm sure that with as much money at stake as there is, that you'll find Google and other companies quickly figuring out how to control this. But at the moment, it's scary, and it's something that could affect it.
Well,
I think
right.
The other thing, Joe, is that when we think about the business implications of these security and privacy issues, what it means is that when we as companies think about how we want to approach our customers and prospects, we now have to imagine that people are getting more paranoid, that when they see things in their mailbox that look too cute, or they might be asking them to go to another site and log in or to put personal details in, that it might be legitimate and you might not think of it as intrusive, but because they're already inflamed and irritated by these other let's say evildoers, that they may not participate, and that could be something that you're not able to control. So again, the takeaway perhaps for our listeners is think about the environment out there, the psychological environment that people are in today because of all of this this security and privacy stuff, and approach them in a way that makes them feel comfortable in engaging with you.
Yeah, and I think we all have to band together to fight these things like spam and fraud and click fraud and all of these things, because they're going to really kill the internet as a marketing medium. And if you think about email, the killer app for the internet has always been email.
That's right.
The thing that really has driven the growth of email. But spam has almost killed email marketing as a way of selling, because there's just so much spam out there that people are really hesitant to open emails and all. And
something like two-thirds of the email that gets sent today is spam.
Yeah, and this click fraud could kill online advertising as well. And so I think those of us in the industry really have to focus on eliminating the evildoers, as you call them, because they're going to destroy what is potentially a great way to sell and market and it will really affect business development in the long run if we don't do something about it.
Okay,
and we spent a little bit of time on security and privacy, but that is an important issue that will continue to be a trend, I think, in 2006 and beyond.
And we'll revisit it because each of these items are subjects that I'm sure you'll be wanting to hear more about as the year progresses. So look forward to more on this.
Right. Our third trend is open source. And open source is something we're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about. According to The Futurist, which is a magazine that I get in an organization that tries to predict future trends, they say that the open source phenomenon will transform employment as radically as blogging has changed the field of media and journalism. That's a pretty bold statement. So what is open source and why should we care about it in business development?
Open source is a peculiar phenomenon because when you first hear about it, you wonder how this could ever work. But it was like that when we talked about Google as well. At the beginning, people said, how can you build a business by giving things away for free? How do you do that? It just flies in the face of everything traditional that we know about business. You provide a service, you get paid for it. But with Google, what they found was a way to monetize what they were doing without having to charge the consumer of their services. So with Google, it was simple. Let people use the search engine, put ads on it, and charge somebody else. So you keep getting search for free. Now with software, it's a little more complicated. The traditional software industry is built on a very simple model. You build software, and then you sell licenses to use it. And then you sell maintenance to keep your licenses up to date. And if it's run right, it's a little cash engine. It just keeps turning over the dollars. Long after people have bought the product, they're still paying maintenance on it. And for the longest time, probably the last 20 years, this has been the standard way that software has been put into force in this country and around the world. So what's happened with open source is kind of like what Google did on the search engine side. What they said was, in the open source side, let's give people the basic software for nothing. Then let's sell them the maintenance and the services around it, the manuals, the documentation, the training, any updates and things like that to get them quickly. And as people in the software industry know, the maintenance stream over a period of years can actually be much greater than what the original license costs were anyway. So there's actually some basis for this if you look at the traditional industry. But what we find are two kinds of companies that are producing open source today. And one of them you're probably familiar with because of the news that it's gained, which is Firefox, which is an open source web browser that is based upon the old Netscape browser, which went open source when AOL bought it. And they've really brought it up to the level where it can actually compete and even replace, in many instances, the use of Microsoft's Internet Explorer. And this is really based on an organization that does not see itself as a profit-making company. So they're doing it because these are passionate people who want the browser to be better and so forth. That's not the way all the open source products are done, though. Another good example is one we talked about when we did our best of the 2005 products, which is the Sugar CRM solution. CRM being a customer relationship management system. And of that type of product, the one we're probably all most familiar with, the one that's really won over the most of the market, is called Siebel. And Sugar CRM does a lot of what Siebel does, and probably for most people, it does more than they need and more than enough to get their business. How does Sugar do it? Sugar is an honest-to-goodness for-profit company. They've recently raised about $20 million in venture money, and they're out to make a profit. And they do it based on the services that they provide, which is very much like the way Linux is coming up. Red Hat is the success story, the poster child for Linux, and they're making very good profits these days, entirely based on the services that they sell, the documentation, the training, and so forth.
Isn't this going to radically change the software industry? And by the way, in the spirit of full disclosure, Roger and I both spent quite a bit of time in the software industry and did very well in the old model, but I think that this is really transforming the way that software companies operate, and it's creating a great opportunity for the consumer. And as Roger indicated, to get into some of the software like a CRM system and offer a big company, or somebody like an ERP company, an implementation just of the initial licenses could be $50 million, and then with implementation, $100 million before you're getting any value out of this software. And so this is a different approach. And I think the other aspect of it is you're not dependent upon one vendor to provide your services. If they go out of business or they raise their prices, you're stuck. But in this open source world, there's a lot of sources of support.
That's right. And it is going to change the world a lot. And one of the things that it's going to do, and for companies who are trying to grow, is give them a chance to use some of these products and really figure out whether they can survive them before they start making huge financial commitments. Because putting a CRM system in, as Joe just indicated, can be very costly and also can consume a lot of energy for a lot of people in the company. It's strategic. And before you make that kind of commitment, you might want to play around with it in the sandbox a little bit. With commercial software, you pay before you play. So open source gives you a chance to figure out what you want to do. If you're in the business of selling products and you don't use a CRM system today, here's a great opportunity to get your feet wet and get started with one and start to pull some of the benefits in without having to make such a huge investment.
Do you have to be a geek to be able to implement open source software? Do you have to be a real technical person?
You don't have to be any more of a geek than you need to be to install Siebel, for example, to deploy Siebel to your people. But at the same time, and this goes to a different question, but open source is often linked with software as a service, something we're going to get to a little later in today's broadcast. And by that, what I'm saying is that a software product which you can use across the internet without having to deploy it on your hardware is a very interesting alternative. And with open source, it's going to be a lot cheaper, even though you're still getting it over the internet, than if you do it with one of the companies that provides it as a service for money.
Let's look at our fourth trend, digital everything. I think digital everything, really what we're talking about here is convergence. And I love this quote from Time magazine. This is what used to be known in the quaint parlance of the now distant 1990s as convergence. So have we already reached convergence?
We have, but it's not quite there yet. We're kind of like on the freeway, but there's no exit where we want to get off exactly. And we have to go a little further and then drive on local roads back a mile or two to find our place. It's not quite there. One of the things, for example, that I think when we talk about digital everything, the big advantage is that portability. Once it's in digital data form, you can move it around between platforms. And for example, if you have a TiVo in your house, a digital video recorder, and it's attached to a television set in your living room, and then you're up getting ready for bed and you wanted to watch that movie that you recorded downstairs, to do that today is almost impossible. You have to be a geek. You got to have friends who know what they're doing. You probably have to create a network in your house that requires a network manager. You know, it's right. It's daunting. So I understand that in 2006, a trend we can look for is that you'll see appliances coming from the major players like Sony and even Intel in this area to be able to move the things around that you've already got and be able to sit in front of any television and look at internet content that you're pulling down from there. And moving everything digitally and onto the internet is going to change pretty much the whole way we view entertainment and the way we can use it in our lives.
Well, that sounds a little like web TV.
It is, actually, but it's even beyond that, because TV is really stuff that's made for television, but you have this vast amount of content, thousands of movies. I don't expect this in 2006, but not in too many years, you'll be able to pull down probably hundreds of thousands of video pieces with a click of a mouse, just like you can do today with text documents.
and play it on any of your TVs.
Anywhere you want, and including your iPod that does video, and the screens in the back of your SUV if you can still afford to put gas in it.
Right, just to keep it parked.
Right.
But I think the example that most people can relate to of this whole phenomenon of digital everything is really music. Now, when you download a song from iTunes, it's in a digital format. You could either play that song on your PC, which is something I do all the time. You can burn it to a CD if you want, or you can send it to your iPod. So the flexibility is there. You can do almost anything you want with it once it's in digital form. The question that I have is, what are the implications of this to people in business development, and what can they do with this whole concept of digital everything?
Well, I think the first thing that every company should ask is, do they have anything in the neighborhood of intellectual property that they could sell in one form or another in this digital marketplace? For example, just to pick some wild thing, if you've made training tapes over the years, audio training tapes, imagine those could be podcasts tomorrow. Maybe you've got video, training videos. They could be out there. It's time to start looking for these things. You know, cash in the attic. What do you have sitting around that you could repurpose now that this new portability is coming out?
Yeah, and I think if you look at the field of training in particular, a lot of people have their training in PowerPoint.
That's
you
right.
You can basically take that PowerPoint and with some tools, you could turn that into training and online training, and you can also turn it into online courses. And
exactly.
So I think the point is that there are a lot of applications for something that maybe you created for one use. You can really use it in many ways. Maybe you could take that online training module and put it on your website and people can download it. So there's a lot of applications of this in the area of IP. What about any other things that you can think of for business development?
Well, certainly it also raises the question as to how you actually use material that you buy from other people. So if you do get the rights and you want to train your sales force, for example, there are things you can get from other companies that were probably traditional materials that you can use in new ways by doing the training across the web and that sort of thing. So I think it goes in both directions. As consumers of this stuff, how can we use it better? And particularly in business, how can we use it better? And also as producers of content, what can we do to make it more useful?
Yeah, and I think one of the things we want to talk about too is sort of the mashing of these trends. Some of these trends really work hand in hand. For example, if you take some of this digital everything and you combine it with collaboration, you can have digital training, video, and combine it with your collaboration. And so I think one of the things we want to probably look at, if we had an 11th, it would be the mashing of trends.
That's right. It's besides convergence, it's now reassembling, disassembling, and reassembling things in interesting ways.
Yeah, and one of the things, the messages that we have is that often when these new technologies come out, you use them basically the same way you use the previous technology. And the example, I think we've even covered it, that's often given is television. When television first came out, people basically did what they did on radio. The first shows were all basically radio shows that you could see, and there were people reading the news, and they didn't really take advantage of all of the capabilities of television for quite a long time. And really, in a lot of ways, it wasn't until series like Star Trek and some others came along that really started taking advantage of the visual aspects of television that it became its own independent medium. And I think we're in the same kind of situation now where we're using things like podcasting and blogs and a lot of the other technologies that are available in pretty much the same way we use the predecessors. You know, most podcasts are kind of like a radio show.
You know, the most compelling example I can think of how someone is making money off of something you never thought could produce any more money is the fact that they sold about $1 billion worth of ringtones last year for
Absolutely.
Cell phones.
Yep.
And there's something which doesn't cost the musicians anything to produce, doesn't hardly cost anything for the record companies, and yet they're bringing in literally $1 billion from this content that they never thought they'd sell again.
Sure, you can imagine these one-hit wonders who were playing the state fairs, all of a sudden now they're waiting at their mailbox for the check because somebody's using, you know, the first three bars to their song as a ringtone.
So you got to be creative when you think about what the new consumers are going to be willing to spend money on.
let's quickly move on to our next trend, and that's enabling technologies, bandwidth and storage.
Well, sure, to feed all of that. Once we go digital, you now are in the position where you have to save and secure all of this digital information, which is usually on computer disks somewhere, either a hard drive in your computer or a little flash drive, thumb drive that you carry with you, or a flash card that's in your cell phone or on your iPod. All of this needs more storage. And, of course, once you have all of your family's pictures and Aunt Sally's on your computer hard drive, you don't want to lose those. So now you need backup. So you have to double up the hard drive space that you used to have. And if you want to start sending these things to people, you need what we call a broadband connection, a high-speed internet connection. Because although it's perfect, whatever you send will come out the other end just like you put it in. There's no loss. It takes a big fat pipe to carry a lot of these digital signals across it.
Right. In years past, we had T1 lines into our offices, and that's how we got such great bandwidth. But in the last 10 years, with the advent of DSL and with cable modems, now over 50% of the people in the United States have access to these high broadband capability systems. And that's what's really driving this growth in video and driving this growth in the ability to use much larger and larger files.
And if you paid attention to the product podcast, we spoke of Skype, which is a voice over IP service, meaning that this is now an alternative to your usual telephone. Joe and I are using it right now to actually produce this podcast, that not only will you be sending pictures and email, but your phone calls will go over this circuit as well.
And the iPod Nano really is just a little flash memory capability in the iPod that allows it to store so much. And we all have seen these little thumb drives that we can store all kinds of presentations and all that. So this is really an important trend because it's really enabling and facilitating all of the other things we're talking about. Having that big pipe allows you to do a lot of the other trends. Anything else on those enabling technologies?
No, just this last comment that storage, making hard drives, has not been a particularly sexy industry. Watch in 2006. I think it will become that.
Really? Yep. Okay. Well, you heard it here first. our next trend number six, is globalization. And we all have to acknowledge that this has become a global economy, and there's no question about it. And you have to think global and act global in this economy. And the numbers speak for themselves. China is growing at a dramatic pace. They're on pace for 9% GDP growth in 2005. And, of course, we'll see the numbers soon. India is growing at 7 or 8%. And with our growth rate at about 3.5%, you can see that over time, these countries and these regions are really going to become important. So what's your thoughts about globalization?
Yeah, globalization, Roger, is often a painful thing to go through. And I think one of the areas where we see this the most, and certainly has gotten a lot of publicity, is offshore outsourcing. Where,
yes, right,
when you start to place work on a global basis, you sometimes come up with an answer that locally might not be the one you'd like to hear, which is that it's cheaper to make it or do that service in another country than it is to do it in the United States. And while we've had these kinds of trends in the past, such as the textile industry moving from New England down to the South and then leaving the South and going to China and other foreign countries, while these have happened for years and years, they're never very much fun for the people who are losing their jobs. On the other hand, these trends do tend to be sort of inexorable, that unless you put up barriers, trade barriers, which have been shown to be negative to everybody, these things tend to happen at the pace they need to happen, not the pace we'd like them to. And one of the trends that we're going to be seeing, here's another prediction, Joe, in 2006, is that on the outsourcing side, we're going to see these jobs going that are higher on the food chain. In the past, these have been sort of entry-level positions, taking answer phone calls on a help desk or doing base programming. But I think what we're going to be seeing grow, and we did see it start in 2005, are things like analysis of data, actual medical and accounting and legal functions, like in the radiology business. They're now reading x-rays at night and on weekends in India, And in Australia and other places, they're going to be able to do pathology analysis because they're using, again, back to the digital convergence, they're getting images, they're getting information that has been produced by equipment digitally. Very easy to send it anywhere in the world, very easy to send it back again. So in all of these fields, we're going to see this trend increasing dramatically.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see some populist pushback because a lot of people are really concerned about a lot of the factories closing and the jobs going overseas. But I think you're right. This trend is going to continue because part of the reason for that is the very technology that we created in Silicon Valley is driving this ability, this great communication capability and this bandwidth and all the things we've developed, the software, is really fueling this globalization. And in fact, speaking of Silicon Valley, there's a phenomenon going on right now that's mini multinational global startups. So these are companies that are multinational from the get-go. They'll have a headquarters in Silicon Valley, maybe their marketing function, their CEO, business development, and then they'll have their development or their manufacturing capabilities somewhere else. In the case of development, they may have their developers and programmers in India. If it's manufacturing, maybe they're in Taiwan or in China. And so these companies are designed from the beginning with this in mind. In fact, there's even some talk that you can't get funded from a venture capitalist unless you have this kind of model that shows the efficiency of programming abroad, but recognizes that it still makes a lot of sense for a technology company to have their headquarters here in the States.
And the implications for this are not simply that you need to go outsource, but probably that you need to develop the capability to manage your supply chain that way, such that you can outsource. Because companies that have grown up doing everything under one roof really don't have the internal systems or controls to be able to outsource safely to distant places. So it's not just the desire, but it's also the skill set and the ability to do this properly.
Right. And so this is a trend that's going to happen. And I think you just have to climb on board and make the best of it. So should we look at our next trend, which is online collaboration? Now, this is something Roger and I have been doing for years.
That's right.
We haven't lived in the, I don't think we've ever lived in the same city.
No, we haven't, actually.
Yes, we did. We lived in the, when we lived in England.
No, I was, no, just not
well,
to argue,
Surrey.
I was about 40 miles away from you, but that's,
right.
But we worked,
in the same office.
That helped.
Right.
That helped.
But that was back in 1995, so we've been able to collaborate and continue our friendship for years using a lot of these collaboration tools. And one of them is Skype that you mentioned. But so what do you have in mind when you're talking about collaboration?
Yeah, you know, what is collaboration? I mean, in its base, simplest form, when you get on the telephone with somebody and you brainstorm or you share ideas, you're collaborating. Some of the best collaboration occurs in hallways outside of offices, not in conference rooms where, you know, not a whole lot takes place in many cases, but in hallways and in lunchrooms, the collaboration tools could be something as simple as a napkin and a pencil. Some of the best ideas in the Silicon Valley have been drawn out on a napkin over a couple of drinks.
Yeah, or breakfast at Buck's.
Exactly. So what we're talking about is something that is very natural and something that we enjoy doing and get a lot of value from, but it's back to this digital. How do we take advantage of the tools that are possible across the internet? It's obvious with voice we can do that, but there's some more exciting things. Some of the components of what we would consider to be a suite of online collaboration tools would include, and I'll give you a little bit of a laundry list here, voice, like what you're hearing right now, video, which doesn't necessarily mean you're just looking at the other person's mug, because that might not be that interesting, but you could be looking at an Excel spreadsheet, or you could be looking at a PowerPoint presentation, or even a little bit of a training video that they're putting on there. A shared whiteboard, which you can both draw on that shows up on your screen instead of on the wall. The ability to share an application, like working on the same Word file or the same Excel spreadsheet together. To trade files while you're talking. It's like, kind of like sending a fax to the other person while you're talking to them and they can see what's going on. Or to even just take control of somebody else's computer desktop. Voting. Often in these collaboration tools, you'll see that as a capability. If you've got a large conference, you could say, how many people are having trouble with this idea? And you throw your hand up electronically and the person who's moderating can figure out whether they're heading in the right direction or not. And last but certainly not least, you can record the whole set of interactions, including the movie that you show, the video, the spreadsheets, the applications, can all be recorded for later playback analysis or just for other people who couldn't be there to take a look at. So it opens up a huge amount of opportunity.
Yeah, and the applications that you could look at for your business are actually doing sales presentations using these collaboration tools. You can do webinars. You can do training. And we would recommend that you check a couple of these out if you haven't.
Quarterly presentations to shareholders. If you own any stock, check your company out. Probably every quarter they go on the web and do one of these webinars instead of the old-fashioned sit in a hotel room with reporters.
Right, and this really became a prevalent technology after 9/11 when people really didn't want to travel on airplanes. But the way that I kind of categorize it is if you used to take 4 trips to Buenos Aires, now you can take 2 and do 2 of them over the internet. So what it can do is substantially reduce the amount of travel. The other application is I think it can compress the sales process by allowing you to do a number of the early steps, like your first initial contact, your first initial presentation, using the internet and not having to get on an airplane. I still recommend that you get knees to knees with whoever it is you're working with and establish a relationship. But these tools are a great way to really compress that front end of the sales process. And I would suggest that you go out and you look at tools from WebEx, who's a leader in this area. Microsoft, who bought a company called Placeware, has something called Live Meeting now. There's a company called Raindance, GoToMeeting. Go check these out and give them a try and see what applications you can come up with for your business.
And don't
Any last parting thoughts on this?
Yeah, there are also conference calls, the good old-fashioned conference call, where you can take 2 or 3 people or 6 people, or if you're making an announcement, a couple of 100 people, and put them on the same phone line. And I'm going to put a link on our podcast site for one that does it for free with up to 200 people included on the call. So it may be not quite as sexy as some of the multimedia stuff, but phone calls, I think, probably give you about 80% of the value of a video conference.
Right, and free is always good.
Free
we
is
like
wonderful.
Free. So let's move on to number 8. Now, we've spent a lot of time talking about this one, blogging, vlogging, and podcasting, and we believe that they're going to go mainstream this year. And in one of the previous podcasts, we talked about the numbers for blogs. Well, I'm happy to report that blogs have gone over 20 million. And there are now 20 million blogs out there, which is just an amazing number. And Roger, you had some numbers on podcasts. Any recent information on that?
Yeah, the current number of individual podcasters, that is to say individual podcast series that are happening right now, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000. Now, you have to keep in mind that podcasting is very new. It really came into being in 2005, but the rate at which it's going to grow will put it up into the much bigger numbers very, very quickly. I think there's something like 10,000 new podcasts a month coming on the scene, and that number will increase dramatically as well.
Right, and we're happy to report you're listening to the number one podcast for business development.
That's right.
Keep out of those 40,000, we're number one in business development. So we're going to spend more time talking about podcasting and blogging and vlogging in subsequent podcasts. But by mainstream, what we mean by that is it's becoming a mainstream way of getting information. People are looking to blogs, they're looking to podcasts, they're looking to these video blogs for their news, for their information, for specific domain knowledge about a topic area. And we think that trend is going to continue, and that by the end of 2006, most people will have heard of blogs. Now, I think it's safe to say that probably at least 50% of the people you talk to haven't heard of one of these things.
That's definitely true.
By the end of 2006, we think this will be a mainstream way that people are going to get knowledge and information. Okay, next, 9, the shoestring renaissance, 21st century version of the garage startup. What do you mean by that? That one was yours, Roger.
Yeah, so this is I think a good one, because a lot of these high-tech projects have a sort of a – there's an urban legend that they start in garages, and there were some famous ones. Hewlett-Packard, most famously, was started in a garage. Apple Computer was started in a garage. I understand Google was started in a garage too. Now what's happening is that you don't need the garage anymore, because with a podcast like what we're doing, you can sit in your office at home or at work. You can put all the tools you need right on your computer, and you can actually produce a podcast. In fact, in some of the upcoming segments of our podcast, we're going to teach you how to do it, and we're going to show you how easy and inexpensive it is to do these things on your own. But this
I don't
really
know about easy.
easier if you know what you're doing than if you don't.
That's true. I'll agree with that. Yes, I totally agree. If you look at how we've created this podcast and the blogs and all, it really is amazing. Now to be able to broadcast and to and using something like iTunes, literally thousands, if not ultimately millions of people can actually tune in if you have something to say. And we're looking forward to getting to that level. But we're using tools now that are either free or very low cost. And so instead of having to invest thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars in these software tools and the technology to be able to implement them, now for a few bucks you can start your own little shoestring business, and it's really, really very neat.
And one of the characteristics of these shoestring startups is that you can do things very, very quickly. So if you're responding to changes in the marketplace or to changes in things that your company is able to do, you don't have to engage a production company and spend months getting this ready like it's a Hollywood production. You can literally have your message out there an hour after you decide you want it. And that's very much one of the characteristics of this internet age.
Yeah, so even if you're working full time for the man, you can take time to investigate some of these technologies and get your own thing going. I mean, blogging and podcasting are a great way to establish your expertise and to share that expertise with an audience. So we encourage it, and we're going to help you see how you can do that. And we're going to provide some of the tools and how to do it.
And one of the skills that we'd like to see you get over your listening hours with us is how to get to the podcast that will help you learn things, because there is an amazing amount of knowledge that's out there now, and part of the trick is knowing how to find it.
Right, so we're going to cover that. So our final trend for 2005 is what we're calling, drum roll please,
software as a service.
Software as a service, that's correct. And the example of this that many of you may be familiar with in business development is Salesforce.com. And the idea here is that you no longer have to buy the software and load it into your computer and pay those license fees that way, and then buy and get a subsequent release that you have to pay for and install on your computer. That this is all resident on somebody else's server, and you just basically get online and use the software.
I think one of the costs that's most difficult for companies to quantify, and then when they do, to accept, is the amount of support that it takes to implement and maintain a sophisticated computer application. And I've run big computer departments, and I've been CIO of companies, and when you install a product that's going to be used by people in the company as part of their job, when it's mission critical, you have to think of all the things that can cause it to break. The network could go down, the computers can go down, software gets bugs. It ends up costing you more over the time that you've owned that software to keep it running than it did to buy it in the first place. So when you buy software as a service, all you're doing is bringing up something on your web browser that somebody else now has computers, network connections, engineers keeping it working in the background. That really reduces the aggravation level and in many cases improves the performance of the application at a much lower cost.
I have one question for you, Roger.
Yeah.
Back in the old days, companies used to basically write their own software, and that software was tailored to their specific business needs. And then with packaged software, you were able to modify that software to your needs. Now, how does that work with this services model?
Well, it can be both a blessing and a curse. Because if you really still need something that's highly customized to your specific requirements, you might be better off building it yourself even today, even though that's not the standard way of doing it. Often what you'll find is that of 7 pieces of software in an enterprise that are important to you, only one really reflects the unique business process that you use. Maybe that's the one that you have to really highly customize or build from scratch. So it's not a question of choosing. I'm going to go all off the shelf, or I'm going to build everything myself, or I'm going to just get software as a service. I think the question in the future going forward is, what is the mix? What is the blend? And typically what we find is that there's a rule of thumb that the processes that make your business really uniquely competitive are things that should really be done by you. The software is not going to come off the shelf. It's not going to be a cookie cutter piece. But for the other pieces, which are very standard, like HR software, if HR isn't a core competency, if you just have HR to hire people and fire them and so forth, probably any off-the-shelf or even a service-based software would work just fine and for a lot less risk and cost.
Right. And there's other examples of software. It's not just Salesforce.com. For example, many of these web collaboration tools we talked about are basically service models. The tools you use to create podcasts, like TypePad and some of the others, and blogs, they're also on this service model as well. So you're probably using a lot of software right now that's already using this. And I think, as Roger mentioned, a lot of the applications are going to go that way. But for your specific mission-critical applications, you're probably still going to want to have your own customized applications.
That's right.
Well, this concludes the fourth in our series for top of 2005. Our first was our top technologies, followed by our top products, our top companies, and today was top trends. So stay tuned in 2006 for some exciting podcasts about things that are going to help rock your world and help you establish a greater presence in business development.
And I'd also like to invite all of our listeners to talk back to us. On our site, you'll see that there are a couple of blocks you can select, one of which gives you the ability to talk to us literally if you've got a microphone or just to send us a conventional email. We'd love to hear about what you're interested in hearing about, and that will help us understand how to serve you better in 2006.
Yes, so Happy New Year. Have a great and prosperous 2006, and stay tuned. This is Joe Cullinane.
And this is Roger Green.